It's very nourishing to walk into a bar and find out there's more lighting happening than drinking.
Just about.
A good buzz, I think. And it's also humbling to come up here after having written a poem on the spot. It's helping me save my life. So hard acts to follow, but I thought I would start with a warm poem since, you know, Storm Ciara has been battering us. We drove down the coast here from Sligo the last few days. And I, as was said, I was born in Dublin, the other capital. And I've been 30 years in California now, so I'm not really used to Irish weather anymore. So I thought I'd start with a warm poem to kind of warm myself up. And I live in a place where we have this exotic thing called a rainy season. So from May to October, it doesn't rain at all, right? Which sounded great to me when I got there. But in the last few years, with climate change and everything, the fires have become worse and worse. And every year now, there's some town swallowed up by fire in September or October or November. And this year, they name the fires like they name the storms here. And this year it was the Kincaid Fire. And the other thing going on in this poem is that while that fire was burning, I went up to see an art show where there were a lot of different media used in the pieces of art, and they were all listed out on bits of paper beside the art. And it was kind of like tiny poems. So like any self-respecting poet, I pilfered those and put them in the poem. So this is called Kincaid Fire. How little we know of any hour beyond this hour. The backdrop to everything is joy. The backdrop to everything is fear. Wind shakes the redwood rain free of the trees, a natural stripping down of the leaves, a natural catastrophic fanning of the flames. There is no limit to the elements of art. Lead, earth, oil, straw, seeds, etched polished glass, paper, pins, hand-wrought copper, gold paint. These are the things we wrap around ourselves when we are hurt. The backdrop to everything is love. The backdrop to everything is fear. Three-color sugar lift and photogravure. Everything we'll ever need is here. Steel, plaster, wedding dress, razor wire. How little we know of any hour beyond this hour. The absolution of every forest is fire. So, when I'm not making vast sums of money as a poet, I have a job, and that's as a hospital nurse, as was mentioned, and that informs my poetry a lot, as you can imagine. I mean, death, what's not to love, to write about. And so the next few poems are about my nursing practice, and this one, there's a lot of stories, you know, you meet people at the end of their lives and they have their whole vast, rich experience behind them and family stories, and you learn a lot about them. And this man that I came to take care of, he was what we call short length of stay, so he was very close to death when I walked into the room the first time. But his wife was there and she didn't know how close he was. She thought maybe, you know, a little round of antibiotics and she'd be fine. So I had to tell her, nope, he's not that long to go. And I became very close with him in a few days. I was visiting every day, and when he passed, it affected me a lot. So the next day I went to the beach, which is my place to go and kind of slough it all off. And there was a little boy kneeling in the sand looking out to the sea, and I thought maybe that was the man's spirit, or it was like his spirit. So this is called Imaginary Hospice Nurse. When I show up for death, I take off my 1,000-pound weight, so I go in light, and I wait there by the bedside for death to look up. There's family, a daughter, a wife, a son flown in from the East Coast, and death thinks this is all so fine. He has the elixir for the dying man in his coat, in the pocket of his heavy coat. But I am the hospice nurse, and I have something too. I have a comfort kit for when death decides to really come out with it. The 21-gun salute, the frothing at the mouth. After I lay down my cloak for the dying man, and the son calls out, "Dad, Dad, it's me." It's not good or bad, but he can't hear him.
He can't hear any of them. He is on his knees in the fine sand, staring out to sea. So before I was a hospice nurse, I was a neuro rehab nurse, and I dealt with a lot of brain trauma, you know, traumatic brain injury and strokes and a lot of young people. And I worked in a small hospital with 12 beds, and there were two nurses on the floor at any one time, 12-hour shift, you couldn't leave the building. So you really became enmeshed with your patients while you were trying to rehabilitate them back into their lives after some catastrophic accident. So this is called Sailing. I'm in a place where much hurt comes to rest. A confluence of pain and rapture, laughter and despair. Hunger is acknowledged here. Loss hangs in the air. Grief is recognized, renewed. The broken come here, endure blinding light, engulfing dark. This is a house of ill luck, built upon hope, layer above layer. In this house, let the heart incline toward kindness. The people who stay here sleep the sleep of those who go on losing and losing. They come empty-handed, flung out of the orbit of their lives, run free of ego, drained of their insatiable self-love. I witness the ills that they endure. And when I mourn for them, all the old sorrows rise like water. A cello joins the piano solo in the house of their tomorrows. Midday, I sit out on the hot bridge. The frogs are in concert in the creek. At ease. Small miracles of heat rise off the wood. The planet runs on and on with her disease. But I feel that something good has been promised here. Something bigger than anybody planned. After work, I sit a while in my car before I put it into gear and drive out beyond the daycare center and community church, far past the tidal pull of all my patients' sorrow, tugging at the ropes of the small vessel I will sail back to them tomorrow. Hospice nurse poem. I had a patient, and he, the day that he died, unfortunately, you know, generally when people are in hospice, they may DMR and do not resuscitate. So if they go into cardiac arrest or something, we don't do CPR on them. But this man's family hadn't been able to sign that paperwork, and so when he went into, you know, his final dying throes, they had to call the paramedics, and the paramedics came in, and it's kind of a not a pretty scene, and I came to work about an hour after that. And I had known this man for a few months, and I had sat with him just the day before, and he didn't seem close, you know, so sometimes it takes you by surprise. And later that day, so we were in this building where the door was always closed, but the paramedics had propped the door open so that they could get him out of the building, and when they did, two small birds flew in, and it was a very high-ceilinged building, and so for the whole of my shift, these two birds were fluttering around the inside of the building, and then eventually they flew down and flew into his room and were by the bed. And yeah, you just have to wonder. So this is called Barns Burned Down, and there's an epigraph by the Japanese poet Mizuta Masahide. He said, "Barns burned down, now I can see the moon." I want to talk about Joe. 4 days gone now. What to write? Not about the death, it was just too much of that, nor about the eerie hush that followed the catastrophe, the shaken nurses who had brought him back temporarily. I want to talk about the palm trees he's not here to see, the tiny leaves and the shining of the white blooms, and the bees' secrets that they will carry back to the hive, just as they did on the last days he was alive. Early spring, such a heartbreaking time to leave. Shouldn't we all die with the falling of the days, towards the shortest light, And not at the moment, nature flutters on the brink, tears in her eyes, ready to break out in her tremulous aria. I want to talk about how I loved to make Joe smile. Rare, grim little smiles, but I loved drawing them out of him. On his last day, he wanted to lift weights. I joked he could help me with my nursing notes. He smiled. Now and then he would grab my arm as I gave him what I called elixir of oxycodone for his pain. Appreciation from someone who can no longer speak is better than words, in any language, anywhere. His last hours were hidden from me, but I was there for his last day. None of us knows, do we? And yet I wonder if the sudden lightening of his spirits was a sign. Maybe he already knew who he was meeting in the faraway town. Whether or not, I want to write about the two small birds that flew in through the propped open door while the medics were busy with CPR. They flew around high up in the great room most of that day, stopping only to gaze longingly out of the windows at the glassed-off world. Eventually, we set one free. The other stayed in the rafters till late afternoon, then flew down and directly into Joe's room. We released him too, free at last how he must have exulted in his flight, up and on up into the welcoming light. Spectrum a little bit and we found out open heart surgery. So my partner George had open heart surgery about 7 years ago to fix a congenital issue, and this was long before I met him, but when we got together he told me about what they had done, and I knew a little bit about it from my nursing training, but his experience is so visceral to the two of us that they flatten your lungs and they stop your heart, and you know, you have a machine keeping you alive for a number of hours. And it made me write a poem. And also there's mention in the poem of some burial, so there's death in there, definitely. But there's mention of the Mimbres Indians, who were the preceders of the Anasazi in the Southwest. They had this pottery that would have people with a little hole in the pottery, and they would put it on people when they died so that their spirit could escape. And the mention of a few things in here is from the Mimbres Indians. And the title is also a reference to the fact that when I met him, I was 3 years post-divorce, and you know, your heart shuts down kind of necessarily at that time, but when George met me, my heart opened again. Open heart. 7 hours in, the lungs are flat, pushed aside, the muscles are cut, and the heart is utterly hushed. The stillness in the chambers chills, and the quiet has a weight, a depth. Add to it a drumbeat, a single horn, a violin, let the boy soprano part begin, and the lush orchestra come in. I cannot bear the silence. Deeply unsafe to love like this, out, far out on the limb. 6 years before I knew of him, he was laid out on the table, bared to the surgeon's blade. Over his face, a cotton mask, hands and feet all painted black, so the clouds could recognize him. And high above, a hole in the dome of the sky, where swallow and shriek could show the spirit a way out, should the spirit need to depart. This man's spirit was titanium strong, and it had already sung a long and complicated song. It hovered close to his heart, on vigil, waiting out the hush. And when the blood shuddered back, and the lungs fluttered and ballooned, it set up its kind of singing once again, sweeter than before, still untempered, rich with pain. So, you know, I've lived in America for a long time, but it's kind of humiliating to admit that I live there now, given what's going on there. And there are certain things that have happened before that were pretty bad. Nothing to compare to what's going on now, but I don't know if anyone remembers, in 2013, the American government was unable to balance the books, and so the whole government shut down. Everything closed. And I live near a national park, and I went out to the beach that morning, which is part of the national park, and I didn't know about the government shutdown, but when I got back, there was nobody on the beach, and I couldn't understand it, and when I got back to the parking lot, they closed it off, because, you know, it was a national park, and the government was closed. So I wrote a poem about it, and the absurdity of it all. It's called Shutdown. The day the government shut down, the ocean showed up for work. They put up some barricades, but waves came in unfazed. The toilets were locked, and the barricades went up to stop the people coming into the park. But we went early before they closed the national seashore, and I can attest that the seals and the pelicans and the small fish and the birds that eat them kept coming back for more. The waves were giving it their all, rending the heart of the beach in two, throwing their violent weight around while Congress ran aground. The rush of foam and fuming toil of the wind blowing spume back from the crests, as loud as the silence along the corridors of power. The sand hot beneath our feet, the water silvery gold, the gulls laughing and crying as we were laughing and crying too. Pelicans flew as low as they dared. We reckoned they hadn't heard that the government was hung, hoist by its own petard. That they'd put up some wooden barriers to stop the tourist cars from visiting the national seashore. While well beneath the roar of the breakers, tearing up the shale and the keening wail of the gulls, the day was a good day, ungoverned, lovely, full of miracles. So I'll read a poem from the view from here, the book before last. The last poem in this book is a favorite of mine. It's kind of an exploration of the human condition and how hard it is to be human and to put up the crap and the how overwhelming life is, and that everybody needs somewhere that they can go, whether it's a physical place or somewhere in your head, poetry or whatever it is. You need somewhere to get away, and I imagined in this poem that that somewhere was a boathouse. Everybody has an old deserted boathouse they drive down to in their second-hand car, swimming naked from the jetty, sometimes going under, the thin green weed for hair, but always coming up for lungfuls of the grey white air. Along the narrow lane to my boathouse, the trees stand up as at a funeral in their new clothes. In the ditches, shooting stars and forget-me-nots I never planted, they arise fragile and lovely without my care. Because I cannot sleep in a cave, in a heavy bed, with the relentless move to entropy that the second law entails, and the yaw and roll of our too small planet pitching among the meteors and the flashing dust clouds. Because of the three stars in a row outside my skylight, just staying there, no comfort in stars anymore, and the slavering of the wolf outside my door, I have driven down to this last refuge of lovers and thieves. Whatever has me staring fixedly into the darkness, maybe I can haul it out of the trunk, bury it in the shaly sand. Maybe I just want my thoughts to stand by themselves by the edge of the gentle water, so I do not have to drive them around anymore, to be eaten alive by their hunger. Eventually, I will be here more than anywhere else, wading out every night, every morning, waking out of the too cold water to the stillness that is just what it is. This, here, now. Poems about my daughter. She's 18 now, and I remember all the way up not being able to believe that she's the age she was. That she's a month old already, and then you know I can't believe she's five. And so this poem is about when she was about to turn 8, and I thought like how intelligent she was already, and the conversations we could have. You know, every stage has its joys. So this is called Approaching 8, and it's for Jessie. At first light, you get in your little boat. It's tippy and there's no one on the shore, nobody waving. In a photo of a million faces, I could find your face. My finger would be drawn to it, even if I didn't look. I never thought 8 would be so fragile, so delicate, so robust, such a synthesis, a symphony, a gallery full of astonishing art. For my part, every now and then, I see where I held the brush. So off you go in your wooden boat, with the warped oars and the peeling paint. I won't stand guard on the shore. I won't even peek from the top window of the house as you punt inexpertly around the lagoon. I will close the door of an inner room, and when you come home with the crab's leg you found for me, still dripping, faintly clicking, we'll have cinnamon toast and tea. You'll clamber on my knee, all elbows and long toes. I might murmur, have fun on the water, and you'll nod, not mentioning how grown up it felt, how scary that moment when the oar rowed up. What a relief to make it back to shore. By tomorrow you won't oar. And for a while, in the quiet ticking of our allotted time, you won't do anything. We won't do anything together. But you will sit enchanted vigil with your life, and I with mine. So the second one I wanted to write, I fast forward a little bit, and she's now of an age where she knows so much more than I do, which is still going on. Apparently I'm still being quite stupid sometimes. She has the ability to just listen to something I'm saying and then go, Mom. Which shuts me up. So when she was 13, she decided that she was ready to drive. And you know, the legal age in California is 16. I mean, there wasn't that long to wait. But she was pestering me for so long that I finally took her down to the beach and let her drive the car for a while. So this is called South Beach. I let her drive on the narrow road down to the beach, between the dunes with their russet ice plant hair. She was 13, piloting the car with infinite care. The sea was boiling mad, climbing the beach, ice green curled over top of the waves, then darker green and churned up sandy foam. She stood at the edge, taking video with her phone. Blonde hair blown across her sea-green eyes. In an instant, the gods could decide to snatch her back. I could no more hold her than the fine sand. I could no more keep her safe than the wind or salty air. But we stood together there, at the ragged edge of the land, and the churn and rush of the waves merged in a rising choir, a melody not sweet, but urgent, uncontrolled. It sang of me and her, of the earth that arose bold from the featureless ocean, the hill of the world, and of all mothers and their wild, unpredictable girls. And the sun god, a phoenix, alit on the hill where we stood, with her filming the waves, and me holding on to her in my mind, in my imagination. So it felt as if I would always have her near. And then we walked back up the sandy path to the car, and we got in and smiled at each other, and I put it in here. Finish off with a couple of poems that about the experience of having immigrated. You know, I've been gone longer than I lived here, and that was a turning point to realize at some point in my 40s, way back then, that I'd lived now in California for longer than I'd lived in Ireland. And as many as you probably know, coming back to Ireland can be complicated when you've left young. You don't know where you've gone, and so much has changed, and you don't recognize it, or it's your home, and it's complicated. So as we were traveling through the West this week, we were seeing the abandoned cottages, some of them still there, and it reminded me of this poem that I wrote right around the time that I was remembering California from in Ireland. It's called Famine Cottages. The horses move across the top of the hill. The water's still a stone below. If I had to let it all in to the places where I feel at home, I'm certain it would take me down. I would be undone. I'd drown. As it is, there is little purchase on my surface, few ways in. The trees send up their prayers for rain. The hills color up at the mention of spring. This year, I have been more than half my life elsewhere. For so long, I have been other, insular, a foreigner with the buried idiom. Across the reservoir, deer paths lace the hill. In my pocket, two stones and a shell from the beach below the famine cottages at Ross Owen. We used to row there in a skiff. Last night, the driving California rain drove home to me how far away are those beaches where we played as kids. Dog's Bay, Inch, Catterseyvine. The dry stone walls squaring off their handkerchiefs of land. New Year's Eve, 1993, I flew across an ocean and 6,000 miles to be where I am now. And this is how I've lived my adult life, away from my original home. In a new place, with new people, an about face from all I'd known. This is what I chose, the airport departure holes, the agonized farewells, and now these hills, my northern moon, my pre-dawn birds. Last poem, which is the last poem in the book, and I always find it hard to introduce because it's one of those poems that I kind of stuffed everything into it. And it's about all sorts of things, but I think it's also about emigrating and flying home and what it's like when I'm thinking of coming home to Ireland, and I'm kind of half there for the last while when I'm in America. And it has a lot of physics in it, that I was reading a book, like kind of the Dummy's Guide to Physics, and I understood it while I was reading it, and I wrote the poem, and now I look at it and go, what the hell is that? So apparently it made sense while I was writing it. It has an epigraph from Albert Einstein: gravity cannot account for falling in love. And it's called Coyotes. 2 a.m. and the coyotes start with their howls of victory and despair. I'm seeing it everywhere. The keys in their jar. The bird that flew up unhurt this morning from beneath the car. An insect's gauzy wings against the lamp. We live as though these things, and how the day went, constitute the only way things are. When I make these journeys back to the country of my birth, it feels like flying into the old territory of my roadless self, my history. Days before I board the plane, I start to shed the layers of it all, like parchment wrappings. Then I step into empty time in the departure's hall. They board the infants, then the first class, then the rest of us. Rush of takeoff, the brilliant sky and the clouds. Because of the uncertainty principle, space is never empty. Because of supergravity and supersymmetry, we have unified theories of everything, including the seven unplanned, curled up other dimensions I can't fully understand. But I have formed my own slender theory of quantum uncertainty, cradled up here in the stratosphere by the laws of nature and the four forces. If all of existence is just patterns of vibrations without width or height, end or start, then what connects us must be the wildness that runs riot in the clamorous chambers of the heart. In the big past, it's understood that stars burned through their hydrogen till they collapsed. Beryllium fused with helium before it could decay to form a stable carbon isotope, which is how I'm sitting here today. Unruly conduit from heart to page, for all the sudden joy, the human hurt and sorrow, laughter, love and rage that makes us undertake these solo expeditions into the territory. There isn't any map. You have to be the architect of your life, the poet of it, hunger for what the future holds, face the inevitable, the unknown, and like the coyotes, pound down the double doors of the night and come out, fires blazing, eyes wide open, heart alight.